Hello and welcome to the final episode of Citizen Kane Minute, the show that examines the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And for this special final, again, episode of Citizen Kane Minute, I thought we would do something in sort of Citizen Kane style and wind all the way back to the beginning, which means we're going to be talking about the trailer for Citizen Kane, which can't be a surprise to most of you, is just as unusual and sort of form-busting as the movie itself. And joining me to discuss the trailer of Citizen Kane is author and teacher Matthew Asprey Gear. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Rob. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here. I am very excited because you, not only have you written a book about Orson Welles, you teach a course about Orson Welles. That is very, very exciting to me. I'm so happy to have you here on the show. Before we talk about the trailer and before I talk to you about the standard questions I've been asking everybody, I talk a little bit about your book and your course, because this is all fascinating stuff to me.
I'll start with the book. I wrote the book a few years ago. It's called At the End of the Street in the Shadow, Orson Welles in the City. So it's a study of his body of work in film, but I guess the angle that I take on it is looking at how he was an urban filmmaker, what he had to say about cities, how he filmed cities. I mean, because he made films all around the world. He shot in many cities around the world. Sometimes he invented his own in the studio or by piecing together all these totally disparate locations in different countries. So that's, I guess, the prism through which I look at his work. But it does also just stand as a study of the films. And so that was the book. And then that came out in 2016. And more recently, yeah, I always dreamed it would be a great thing to teach Orson Welles, to do a whole course on his work. So I'm an academic myself in Scotland here, but I decided to start my own kind of independent online course on the films of Orson Welles, so a 12-week course. And that's been going for the last year. I'm up to the third. I've done it three times now. And yeah, it's just jumping straight into this crazy world of Orson Welles. And funnily enough, we end on Citizen Kane. We don't start as you would expect, because it's not, I don't teach his work in chronological order.
It's a very Citizen Kane-y thing to do.
Yeah, it's all out of chronology. But I mean, in a way, it kind of maybe a bit perverse, but everybody's probably seen Citizen Kane who comes to do a course on Orson Welles. So we can kind of like leave it to the end, even though I sort of know everybody knows what I'm referring to if I do discuss it.
Now, this sort of ties into the question I'll ask you that I'm asking everybody about. When did you first see Citizen Kane? But what was it about Orson Welles's work that struck such a chord in you that you would think to write a book and then teach a course? Because you have to really love something to want to get that deep into it.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I guess, you know, over time, I mean, I always was a fan of Orson Welles, but then over time I became fascinated by the life, the career, especially the fact that he had such an unorthodox career as a director. And I saw a documentary, I guess, back in the 90s called One Man Band, which is all about his unfinished projects of the 60s and 70s and 80s. And that just fascinated me as much as anything else, the idea that there were all these unfinished projects. So I kind of got really, I always had that huge curiosity about that sort of, what are we missing out on? Like all these films he started making or almost finished. And so I guess as time went on and I started to develop a more academic interest in Welles, and I did a chapter of my PhD thesis on Touch of Evil. But eventually I got to the archives, and that's just a total dream to be among all the scripts that he wrote that were never made because he could never find the money. And also, you know, looking at a lot of those unfinished film materials. So I kind of started to realize that the films that we're familiar with, that we're able to access, general public's able to access, you know, they're really just a part of all of the work he was doing. And so I think he just became this endlessly surprising, endlessly fascinating figure to me. And so when I came to decide, yeah, I'm going to do a book on him, I wanted to, you know, definitely follow in the footsteps of a lot of scholars, but really look at all that unfinished work as well and try to consider it as part of a whole So he sort of left behind his own Xanadu of objects in these archives scattered all over the world, because they're not just in the US, they're in Europe as well.
Did you feel like you recontextualized his career by getting access to all that and seeing how much was unfinished and how much was, I mean, obviously what he did finish is an amazing body of work, but when you, mm-hmm. when you had the access to see how much was unfinished, did it ever feel a little like a bunch of missed opportunities? I mean, obviously some of it was missed opportunities, but did it change how you viewed his career, seeing how much stuff never saw the light of day?
Yeah. I mean, it still is doing that because I keep coming back to the materials. I mean, the first thing that people should realize is, you know, it's not as though you can go to these archives and sit there for a few days and read everything. I mean, he left behind thousands and thousands of pages of documents and scripts and drafts and so on. So, you know, it's very hard to even get your head around the extent of work he was doing. But as far as changing my idea of it, I mean, sometimes it seems puzzling at first. Why would he want to make that film? How does that fit into his vision of things? And then, yeah, over time, it just sort of starts to, I mean, I've sort of started to figure out, I guess, my interpretation of what he was all about. And, but I think I'm still trying to get there. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Wells. He's sort of one of these oceanic creative types, you know, like a Mark Twain or a Duke Ellington, you know, a great American artist who, you know, in his lifetime created acknowledged masterpieces and also created a lot of things which maybe people were pretty dismissive of at the time. But after they die, we just keep seeing more and more stuff from these archives that, you know, some of it is better than the stuff that came out when they're alive, and other stuff is terrible, and some of it's unfinished. So it's just it's like an endless puzzle. It's like to keep coming back to these Kane metaphors. It's like a jigsaw puzzle that nobody knows how many pieces there are.
Those are all phrases that are coin of the realm over on my other podcast, Pod Dylan, where we're talking about the work of Bob Dylan, because okay. there's so much material there that never got out, and now it's getting out, and you're like, good Lord, I didn't know this or that. And so it's, by the way, I love that term, oceanic. I think that's a great way of describing Wells. Please tell me that the Orson Welles Archives is like it was at the Walter Thatcher Library, where you were like Mr. Thompson, and it's this massive room with just a one book sitting on a table, and there's somebody just telling you pages 23 to 142 only. Please tell me that that's what it looks like when you went there.
It's exactly like that. It's, you know, you step into the big hall with a big, big statue of Wells looking down over you, and a very unfriendly librarian leads you in and just tells you these pages only. But no, and I wish that I could tell you that. But actually, no, if I told you that, it would be very hard to do very much work in these archives. But everybody I've met in the archives has been, I mean, the librarians and the curators and so on have been, you know, really helpful. And, you know, they're enthusiastic about Wells as well. So, I mean, it's not just in the U.S. There's the two big archives in the U.S. are in at Indiana University in Bloomington, the Lilly Library, and there is another one in the at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. But there's also one in Italy in Turin, and the Munich Film Museum also has a lot of the actual celluloid, so the unfinished film reels. So I've been to all of them, and it's just such an exciting thing to jump in there and see what they have.
That is marvelous. Regarding the people that take your class, I find this interesting. I mean, maybe, you know, you don't exactly know the histories because they're just taking, you know, I don't know how much the interaction is, but like, do you get the sense of how many of the people that take your course are Wells diehards that take it, or there are people who know him a little bit? As you said, anyone that's going to take an online Orson Welles course is going to know Citizen Kane, obviously, but they want to learn more, or is it people that are, you know, as immersed in it as you are, or is it both?
It is both. I mean, there's been people who have been, you know, following Wells, you know, since before I was alive. You know, I mean, they were I mean, I'm 41, but they've been with Wells for many decades. And then there are other people who, yeah, they've seen a couple of the films and they were really fascinated. It's usually Citizen Kane or Touch of Evil, Magnificent Ambersons, and they're just fascinated by what they've heard about Wells. And I think it works for either type of person. The one thing I try to do to make it worthwhile for, you know, those diehard fans who, you know, have seized on every scrap of Wells material they can, is I do try to share my findings from the archives. So I talk about the unfinished projects and the unmade scripts and a lot of stuff which has never been really written about by scholars, because there is just so much. And for the newcomer, it's a way of kind of, seeing the majority of his films. I mean, I don't cover every single one of his feature films. It's in 12 weeks, but get close to it. And I think you get if you're new to Wells, you're going to get a sense of the scope of his career, and you'll watch, the classic core films and some crazier outliers as well.
do you watch some of the stuff that he was just in that he didn't necessarily have a creative hand in, or that he just showed up as money jobs, or do you leave that stuff out?
We don't look. No, I mean, I don't. I'm interested in his career as an actor, but we don't look. I haven't built that into the course, looking at those films that he did for the paycheck. There's a few films that he acted in, which are a little bit more kind of, I mean, they're almost like ghost directed films. Like he sort of had a big hand in them, like Journey into Fear, but maybe Black Magic. But I haven't added that to the course. I mean, there's enough films that he did have his name on.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a combination of, you know, lecture presentations and then group discussion. So, we get right into it. It's really fun for me, too, because I have the perfect excuse to go back and watch all these films again and again and again. Not that I really need an excuse, but every time I do, I always find new things in these films.
Yeah, I can see why, you know, considering how many movies he did for the paycheck, that would get... You know, hey, everybody, we're going to watch Necromancy. Like, okay.
And we'll watch the alternate cut, the European version as well. Yeah.
No,
maybe might need a sort of year-long course to make that work. But, yeah.
So, well, like I said, that is marvelous. So like I talked about earlier, when did you first see Citizen Kane?
Well, I was in high school. I'm from Australia. So it was on television late one night when I was a teenager. And I think actually they were showing a couple of other RKO Wells films. Like, I think they were showing Magnus and Anderson's as well and Journey into Fear. But anyway, wow. I remember taping the movie. And so I didn't stay up to watch it. I taped it. And the next day at school, my good friend was telling me, oh, I saw this film last night, Citizen Kane, you know, and I said, oh, yeah, I taped it. I'm really keen to see it. And then he said, oh, Rosebud's a Sled. And I've almost forgiven him for that.
But, wow.
But anyway, I did watch it. So I missed the first watch where you actually, you know, sit in wonder as you discover what it's all about. But and that was the first time I watched it, and I've watched it quite a lot of times since.
That's your friend really just could not wait to tell you about, but jump right to that. Like, hey, it was the
teenagers slide. Can be cruel. Yeah.
Oh, that's very true.
I've forgiven him now. No, he's made up for it in other ways. But yeah.
So what was it about? Well, you know, as a teenager, what was it that struck you so profoundly? Because as we've talked about in other episodes, it's not aside from being an older film, and you know, a lot of teenagers don't appreciate that. But even if you're one of the kind of kids that does. It's a film about a lot of adult concerns, and I wonder what it is that that a teenager would hook into, because it's about regrets and things that teenagers don't necessarily face at that point in their lives.
Well, probably, I mean, at that time, I was really becoming aware in a critical way of the news media, and so I guess maybe that was the initial interest in the film, that, okay, this is a film exposing, you know, the kind of gutter press, obviously, of a long ago period. But so I probably was interested in it, and that's it. I mean, I grew up, you know, in Australia where Rupert Murdoch runs everything. So, and, you know, I was probably a pretty passionate teenager about, you know, we need a good, valiant press, not some tabloid junk. And so probably that was the initial interest. But then I got, very quickly got interested in Wells as a filmmaker, and looking at Magnificent Ambersons at the same time, I think, and learning about the story of that film and how it was kind of butchered by the studio. And I guess I started to get very interested in Wells as, you know, this maverick artist who was fighting the system and, you know, kind of became a victim of the system. So I guess I saw him as a sort of martyr for artistic freedom or something as well. I'm trying to get back into my head when I was a teenager watching these films. But I mean, I think more than anything, I probably thought they were fun too. And that's something that maybe the, you know, the reputation of Citizen Kane as the greatest film ever made, et cetera. It sounds like homework to watch to a lot of people, but I just looked at it. And for me, it's so much fun. It's so entertaining. And now when I see it, I actually feels like a bunch of 20 something year olds making a fun, you know, making a film and having at their disposal this, you know, great studio and all of its resources. But if feels like a bunch of college kids doing a movie, and I don't mean that in a bad way.
So, yeah.
You know, it's tremendous fun, and I still just really am entertained when I watch Citizen Kane.
Yeah, when I went to see it in the theater a couple of weeks ago, it was part of the Fathom event series, and it was a pretty full audience considering this movie is readily available on, you know, different formats, and it's on HBO Max and stuff. But it was, I was heartened to see that the theater was at least half full on a Sunday afternoon, and probably everybody was there as a diehard fan. That's why else you're going. But it was fun to hear people laugh at the right moments and like react to it in real time the way you do when you're in a movie theater. I've only ever seen the film in the theater one other time, but most of the other times I'm watching it at home by myself. But it was great to hear people chuckle and gasp and, you know, or just marvel at what Orson was putting on the screen. So that was, again, it was a delightful experience. So in terms of it being the greatest film of all time, as you talked about, it's people regarded as homework, and that's the movie has been done no favors by being called that. What other movies in your mind would you put in the pantheon alongside Citizen Kane? What do you think deserve to be listed among, like, you know, and we're always talking about kind of greatest American films, because like I said, my knowledge of world cinema is very lacking, and I feel I have no ability to even come up with a list. But in American films, what other movies would you put alongside Kane?
Difficult question. I'm always bad at coming up with those lists. I mean, I have, I guess, my own favorite films, but then if I try to, I mean, I love, for example, I think I probably love Touch of Evil more than Citizen Kane in a way. And I don't know whether I would say it's a better film, but to me, it's so accomplished particularly in the 98 reconstruction. But a really difficult question to answer. American film. I mean, I love films like Sweet Smell of Success, but these are all, you know, kind of 50s noir. Yeah, I don't know. The Maltese Falcon is a pretty flawless film, I think. What's your vote for number one?
Like I said, I can separate what are my personal favorites versus what I think are probably the 10 greatest films ever made in terms of their innovation, their lasting legacy, their, you know what I mean? And so, you know, the films I put in my head are not my 10 favorite. You know, but I'd like off the, you know, back of the envelope, like I would say if someone came to me and said, what are the 10 greatest American films ever made? I would probably rattle off. I don't even know if this is 10, but I was, you know, Kane, certainly, Casablanca, Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, Lawrence of Arabia.
But Lawrence of Arabia is an English film. Come on.
All right. Come on. But, you know, Pulp Fiction, Star Wars, Annie Hall. Like that to me, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Like that to me, that covers all your bases. It, you know, it spreads it. I mean, I would say in terms of, again, innovation, lasting legacy, that's kind of a list that I would say. And it covers every genre I can think of. You've got comedy, you've got grand adventure, you've got epics, you get in somewhat musicals, Singing in the Rain, throw in there too. That's kind of what I would say. If someone said, we're going to put 10 films in a space capsule and send it out, those would probably be the ones I would do.
I mean, I would put Chinatown in there. Mm. Maybe the first two Godfather.
The Godfather.
Films.
Yeah, The Godfather.
Apocalypse Now. Mm. I mean, I'm really into 70s film. So, I mean, I teach a course in that as well. So I tend to, gravitate towards those films. Although sometimes the imperfect films are in a way more interesting. And I mean, I love Chinatown and I think it's pretty flawless, but I wound up writing a book about Night Moves, which is kind of a similar private detective film from the middle of the 70s. But
yeah, Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman. It's by no means kind of a perfect film. I mean, there's definite flaws, but you know, it's kind of more interesting in a way than Chinatown to me, just because of those flaws. Mm. So it's and maybe that's a little bit why with Kane, as much as I love it, I am kind of more fascinated by some of the less perfect Wells films, like Chimes at Midnight. And I mean, Touch of Evil, I think, is pretty flawless if you look at the 98 version. So but I mean, we're lucky we have so many to choose from.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say one of the saddest moments, I just talked about how much it was enjoyable to watch Kane in the theater a bunch of years ago in the early 2000s. Some theater in New York was showing Touch of Evil, and me and my friends went to it. And I think it was the more recent cut, what you're referring to. And there were some people there who were just laughing at it. Mm-hmm. And that made me so sad, because it's just kind of like, you're not, I don't know. It's like, you're not watching it right. If you're laughing at it and you're kind of too cool for school over this, you're not watching the movie right, because you're taking, like when Marlena Dietrich has the line about, you know, his future is all used up, and people were like, ah, ha, ha, like that's so cheesy. And I'm like, you're not, you know, just kind of like, all right. Okay.
I mean, I guess if you're very used to watching films of that era, I mean, its sensibilities are not that alien
right
to you. Although even I guess for the late 50s, Touch of Evil is still a really strange Hollywood movie. But yeah, I mean, film has changed enormously, and you know, the aesthetics have changed, and you know, when you're not familiar with, I guess, that kind of visual language, that kind of dialogue, and that kind of writing, it does seem kind of to have camp value over artistic value, maybe, to some people. But that's the way it goes.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. So, all right, let's talk about the trailer. This first trailer for Citizen Kane. You know, anybody who wants to see it, you can go to YouTube. It's available. It was on the Blu-ray. It's on the DVD. It's all these things. And it's not the only trailer that exists for this film. Certainly, there were other trailers. There have been later reissue trailers. But the first, this is the one we're talking about, is the first one, which opens with this RKO radio logo, RK Radio Pictures logo, and then we immediately cut to a shot of the soundstage, where there's a chalkboard that said Citizen Kane, Stage 10, and there's this quick camera move into the door, and we fade into the darkness, and then we see this giant beam of light and a hand come in, and we hear the voice of Orson Welles as this microphone is swiveled into the foreground. And we're going to learn that this trailer is, like Kane itself, incredibly unusual. I mean, it says something about how famous Orson Welles was at this point, just through radio, that merely his voice was enough to sort of be the thing that sells this trailer. I mean, outside of Hitchcock, and now I don't even know nowadays, is there even any director, maybe Quentin Tarantino, maybe Chris Nolan, that could be famous enough that they could narrate the trailer to their own film? I know, is there anyone that could pull this off now?
Yeah, maybe Tarantino, but I don't know if he wouldn't do that. But
no.
Yeah, Wells, I mean, I guess you've got to put your head back in the late 30s. Wells became a major celebrity because of War of the Worlds and everything else. But even before War of the Worlds, he was becoming very well known for what he was doing in theater. So he was a big name. People knew the voice, and he makes this kind of very daring decision not to appear, not for his face, not to appear in the trailer, just the voice.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable. And for what, you know, again, in the initial shots, it's just this microphone, you know, as he's as he is talking. And yeah, that's how famous the Mercury Theater was, is that he could narrate this. And again, it's behind the scenes. This is all going to be behind the scenes stuff. And again, I'm not sure how familiar people were with being behind the scenes of movies. And there were certainly movie magazines and things like that. But again, it seems so unique that they would give the audience a peek when you're trying to create this reality that this is a real story, this is really happening. And you're immediately giving people a peek behind the curtains. And there's this shot of all these chorus girls that come running in and dancing, and they're singing along, and they're singing into the the microphone, and Wells makes a joke of kind of bad about this, sort of like, this is sort of a very commercial way to start your trailer with all these pretty girls. And then we're going to get introduced to the cast. And the first person we see is Joseph Cotten. And I don't know about you, but it almost feels like this was completely unrehearsed, because Cotten walks into the frame, and for a good couple of beats, he's in total darkness. And you see someone try and like turn a light on, and you see it flicker once or twice as Cotten looks at it, and he's smiling. And then at one point, the light turns on so brightly, he kind of squints a little because they think it's so bright. And it really feels like they just shot this, and it was not rehearsed. It was like, okay, Joe, just walk into the frame. We'll turn the light on and start talking to you. And he clearly, Wells is talking to Joe Cotten off frame, and he's like, come on, Joe. And you could see Joseph Cotten start to chuckle. And it really feels just incredibly improvised.
It has that feeling of spontaneity, even though I'm sure, knowing Wells' work, that there's a lot of fakery going on. But,
right.
But yeah, I mean, one thing that strikes me is that he was really proud of this cast, and he also wanted these people, all these newcomers to film, to be celebrated as a kind of repertory company in the Mercury. And that comes across very strongly. I mean, it's all about introducing the audience to this great bunch of actors, and many of whom would go on to just have these very illustrious careers in Hollywood.
It's really charming. Again, I love the way Joseph Cotten sort of chuckles a little. And then we get introduced to Ruth Warwick, and they're all acting like they don't know the camera's on them, which is, again, a great bit of fakery, because they're all like, oh, hi, Orson. They don't know that. like he just showed up. And we see Ruth Warwick, and then we get Ray Collins. I love him smoking a cigarette, which, as I talked about in an earlier episode, this ended up killing him. He ended up with severe health problems, so it's unfortunate we're seeing him smoking there. And then we get a shot of Dorothy Cummingore in front of a microphone, and there's this big silence sign behind her. She looks quite happy to be there. Reminds me a little bit of Noel Neal from the Adventures of Superman TV series. She kind of has that look. Then we see George Koloris in this upshot, and George Koloris looking very different than how he looks in the movie. Of course, this is what he looked like in real life. He was a younger man, but in the film, he's always played old Thatcher and stuff. Now, this stuff, this scene with him, when we see the camera rig go over him, it's only until at one point that he kind of looks into the camera as if like he doesn't know it's there. And then we get this goofy thing with Everett Sloan, where he runs into a door at double speed like he's a Keystone Cop. And then we see another piece of Citizen Kane trickery where he looks like he's running towards the camera, and then we realize, no, we're looking into a mirror, and he comes into the frame and bumps into the mirror like Charlie Chaplin or something.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's kind of individualized in their little 5 seconds on film. And they obviously came up with, well, what can each person do that makes them a little bit, you know, memorable? They're not all, none of them are doing the same thing. So, and yeah, obviously Everett Sloan, he wanted to do something a little more spectacular. And maybe it's also just to, because, you know, Mr. Bernstein in this film is kind of doing pratfalls, and, you know, he's knocking over stacks of furniture, and, you know, so I guess maybe he was trying to sell himself as that kind of comedian.
Maybe so. He gets.
But it's so funny because he'd become a very. I mean, he's so versatile as an actor, and he plays completely different characters in all. I mean, the Wells films alone that he does. Mm-hmm. So he's always very, very different.
Yeah, it's really, really silly that he's running around. He could probably have like that Benny Hill music behind him. You know, it's just so funny. and then we get Agnes Moorehead looking really fashionable and ravishing. She's got this sort of, you know, fashionable looking hat. And of course, again, this is nothing have we ever see her in the film. In the movie, she just has that one scene, and she looks like kind of got that spinster schoolmarm kind of look. But here she looks just great. I mean, it's amazing what Wells's crew on the makeup side did to these actors, because they just don't look recognizable in a lot of ways. And then we get Erskine Sanford, where he's petting a parrot on his shoulder. Presumably, is that the parrot with the missing eye that we see later on in the film? We don't know. and then we get Ray Stewart as the butler. He looks right at the camera and he smiles. And then we go back to the microphone, and we get more narration from Wells talking about the Mercury Theater. And again, it really is remarkable when you think about just how famous these Mercury Theater players must have been. I mean, yes, Wells is introducing them, but at the same time, there is a certain amount of that the audience is going to know who all these people are. And that's, I mean, nowadays radio is not drama, you know, dramatic radio is not a thing anymore, but man, that's how prevalent it was in the culture that you could cut a trailer like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's radio was just, you know, one of the, really was the major medium, I think, of the period. And that's, yeah, that's reflected in how familiar we're expected to be with some of the actors. Ray Collins, I think Wells says, you know, you know Ray Collins or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, as if the audience is already going to be familiar with him just because of his radio performances.
Yeah. And then we get to some footage that is original to the trailer. It is a shot of Erskine Sanford playing Mr. Carter doing his best fumfering again. He's master at the...
Yeah, he does a lot of it in this trailer.
Oh, yeah. Man, yeah. This really is like, all right, Erskine, really give me the full fumfer here. And then again, we get Mr. Bernstein again talking. And these are the characters, mm-hmm. Bernstein and Carter, talking about Kane. But these scenes are not in the film. This is all original to this trailer. And then we get George Caloris, Mr. Thatcher talking. We get Ray Collins talking. And they're all referring to whatever interactions with Kane they have. We see that, you know, boss Jim Geddes is talking about, you know, I'm going to run him out of town. He's running for governor. And it's, you know, dropping hints about this guy. And again, it's very reflective of the movie itself, as they have all these people talking about Kane, about how they interact with him. But we don't actually, at no point in this trailer, are we even going to see Citizen Kane. No. And then there's one other moment, which I thought was interesting, is that we have Ruth Warwick playing the president's niece, of course, Emily, talking to Jed Leland, and they are talking as if they are talking to one another. They are having a direct phone call with one another. And that's not anything. They talk about that very briefly in the film, that they knew each other, but this mm-hmm. this is like them directly interacting, talking about Charlie Kane. And then again, you even get Agnes Moorehead talking about her son, Charlie Kane, which of course, again, in the context of the film, there weren't phones when this was going on. So, I mean, this is like really breaking the mold about how you're supposed to keep track of who these characters are and what interaction they're going to have. And it's Wells, like with the movie itself, is just, you know, he's assuming you're going
to
catch up.
I think he's really just, he manages to make, you know, create a lot of excitement around this film that's a coming attraction, but you don't really actually learn very much about what the movie's about. You learn about this character and that's it. It's all just Kane. And who is he? And, you know, he seems to be all this man of contradictions and so on. So your interest is peaked and you're just waiting to see the film. I think something to say about this approach to a trailer. I mean, this is really a short film by Orson Welles. It doesn't use really any footage from the movie. And, you know, Welles did this on a number of occasions. Are you familiar with the F for Fake trailer?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's an even more, well, it's much longer. It's about, I think, 9 minutes long. And that was, I mean, he made a trailer for F for Fake. And this was, I think, about 3 years after this film had come out in Europe. It comes out in the US. And the distributor asked if he would cut a trailer, or maybe he volunteered to cut a trailer. But he made a trailer that doesn't in any way resemble any other trailer you've ever seen before. It is like a kind of short film. And it, too, has plenty of material in it that isn't in the film itself. And but that in this case, the distributor rejected the trailer, so it was never actually shown. Fortunately, it's kind of survived, but it's a similar kind of idea. He's talking about the film, but he's actually talking about the film from the vantage of 3 years after it came out in Europe and what has changed and how Howard Hughes was no longer alive and all this kind of stuff. So that I think Wells was never really interested in doing anything in the conventional way, and that even applied to, you know, trailers for his upcoming films. He wanted everything to be kind of a different sort of event. And yeah, so he does the same with the Citizen Kane trailer.
I guess it's all in how you view the trailer, and that some people view them as just commercials. Mm-hmm. It's just a commercial, and that's how it's cut to be. It's cut to get you into the theater. But yeah, as you talked about the ridiculous 9-minute. That's not a trailer. That's a short film, as you say. I mean, that's not even remotely a trailer. But yeah, this thing sort of exists as a piece on its own, and it ends with again the card that we see that opens the film, which is a Mercury production by Orson Welles, and that's how the trailer ends. Except then there's a title card where it says Citizen Kane and RKO Radio Picture. But yeah, he does regard these as sort of short little films. And I'm not familiar with, I mean, a lot of his films, he probably never had a chance to cut trailers for because they barely got released or whatever. I've never seen a trailer for like Macbeth or anything like that. I mean, it probably exists, but I've never, in my memory, I have not seen one. But again, I have to wonder what an audience in 1940, 41 was thinking when they saw this, because yeah, it's trying to get you excited about this central figure, but it doesn't show you much else other than a bunch of people talking about him, which is kind of a high wire act, because what if it doesn't work? What if people are like, what do I care? Show me something from this movie. It's always hard to base your trailer off of sort of one figure. Although again, you are seeing this cast, he's showing, look at this great cast that I've got in this film. But it's sort of a gutsy move. And I assume that Welles' famous contract that allowed him final cut of the trailer too. Cause I can't imagine RKO was super happy with this trailer.
Maybe, I don't know. I'd have to look into that. And it'll be interesting to see other RKO trailers from around the same time. And you know, what happened when what was the house style for trailers, but this is definitely not it. Yeah. But, I can see also there's this, it's almost as though Welles seems to appreciate that he's making this transition from radio to film. And this trailer is all about that, the way that he uses that image of the microphone just hanging there in the light. And we hear the voice, but it's all about announcing, well, Welles was on the radio, now he's going to be on film. And it seems very much about that, telling that news.
That was a relatively, I mean, I know that a lot of film actors appeared on radio, went on to do production, short productions of their own films, but it feels like the flow didn't go the other direction too much. You didn't get a lot of radio stars that made the jump into films. I mean, it's only been in the last, I'd say, 20 years that all entertainment has sort of sloshed together. And now we are used to seeing actors in TV shows and in movies and in video games and in commercials. It's all the same now. When not that long ago, there were very hard lines between who was on TV and who was in movies. And very rarely did TV people make the jump into movies. Now, it would go the other way when movie actors' careers started to die down and they would end up appearing on television. But I'm guessing that in 1939, 1940, you really didn't get a lot of radio stars making the jump into movies. And so this was kind of a huge deal that this famous guy was, wow, he's in a movie now. That's a big deal.
Yeah. It does feel like something, I mean, the trailer does succeed in giving you a sense that something exciting is happening with all these radio people suddenly in a movie. And I think it's very successful at creating this sense of excitement.
Yeah.
I mean, makes me want to see the movie.
Absolutely. And as far as I know, I mean, if I had ever heard about it, I think I would have heard about it by now. There was never a radio adaptation of Citizen Kane. There were radio adaptations of a million movies, but they never did one of Citizen Kane.
No. And maybe that too was in Welles' contract. I mean, it was, he had the right to prevent any sort of spin-off works. But again, I'd have to look at the contract, but I don't know how it would work on radio.
It's the sled. I'm throwing the sled into the fire. Right. Oh, look, it says Rosebud. It'd be a lot of explaining of things.
I mean, in a way, there's so much in Kane that does seem like an outgrowth from radio because the sound is so amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I couldn't really imagine how it would work on radio.
It would have been neat to try, though. It would have been really neat if Orson had tried it, just to, because then he would have approached it probably as its own thing anyway. He probably wouldn't have even adapted the movie. It would have been just its own separate thing.
I mean, in the 50s, he had, for example, like Mr. R. Cotton had a kind of tryout on the radio as an episode of the Lives of Harry Lime. And he did that with a couple of screenplays in that period. You know, they some of them that never were made into films, but they turned up as radio plays. Like there's one, it was a film script called VIP that was never made, but there was a radio episode of the Harry Lime series that took the plot. So I think he probably had a lot of, he felt very flexible moving between mediums, but no, I can't imagine how Kane would have worked on the radio.
No, it would have been, it's for another world that it exists somewhere. So, well, I said that's going to be it for the Citizen Kane trailer. It was a piece of sort of the Kane history that I've always wanted to talk about. And I was trying to figure out when would be the best time to talk about it in the run of this show. And then I realized, well, no, we'll do a very Citizen Kane thing and talk about it at the end of the show. Even though it preceded the movie, we'll talk about it at the end now that the movie has been completed. So, well, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I look forward to reading your book because I've read a bunch of Wells books and I always find them. I always learn something new, like I did from watching Citizen Kane over and over again. I always learn something new. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been great to be here, Rob.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Yeah, sure. Well, the best way is just to go to www.matthewsbrigier.com, or I'm on Twitter as well, at Matthew Asprey. So, yeah, that's the best way to find out about my film courses, my book, and so on.
All right, excellent. Go do that, everybody. So that is going to do it. I'm going to play some podcast promos, and when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback that has been collected for the previous 24 episodes of Citizen Kane Minute. Stay tuned. It's Fade Out. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, Fade Out will examine the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Greetings, guys and ghouls. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and this is The Monsters That Made Us. Join Monster Mike Manzi and I on the last Friday of every month as we celebrate all of the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios classic monster series. From The Phantom of the Opera to The Creature Walks Among Us, we sink our teeth into all the gory details as we dissect the films that gave us some of the most iconic movie monsters of all time. The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more information, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
And we're back. And before I wrap the show up, I wanted to get to some of the feedback that we got on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. I haven't had a chance to cover the listener feedback over the previous episodes. I wanted to make sure before we wrapped everything up here that I read a few of the comments that the show was fortunate enough to get. Before we even get to that, I want to read the one iTunes review, Apple Podcast review that we got on this show. I very much appreciate anyone who took the time to leave a review for Citizen Kane Minute. And it got 5 stars from Triv, who says, excellent, thorough, and entertaining. Rob Kelly is a great podcaster, no matter the topic, but his love of cinema and his intelligence, wow, really shine through when he tackles a rich subject like the greatest film of all time, or is it? His deep analysis of every 5 minutes of this movie expertly reminds me why it's so revered, and his guests are thoughtful and entertaining. Listen, then watch Kane again. That's a marvelous review, so thank you so much, Triv. I really do appreciate it. That's just great. Makes me feel wonderful. So, okay, let's get to the feedback. As I mentioned, these are some comments that we got over on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. I'm not going to go through all of them. I just wanted to hit a couple. First up was from episode 1, Rosebud. We got a comment from Noah Tarnow, who says, fantastic job, Rob and April. Love the concept, and I love the first episode. How fortunate you are that Citizen Kane's initial 5-minute chunk is among its most iconic scenes. What strikes me most about this opening, and thank you for mentioning, is the radical tonal shift from Kane's death scene to the news on the march rail, which I really think encapsulates the central conflict of Kane's story, the bombastic public versus the pitiful private. Personally, my favorite line in this 5 minutes is "cost no man can say." My best friend and I used to repeat that in various appropriate and not so appropriate circumstances. Thanks for doing this. Looking forward to the next 5 minutes. Thank you, Noah. From episode 3, A Very Simple Thing, Dr. Ann says, I do love the simple thing foreshadow. Wells was really playing with the audience, spelling out the whole plot in the newsreel and then saying that Rosebud won't necessarily be a huge thing. Amazing. I always feel badly for Susan Alexander Kane. I just feel pity for her. And Wells sets that up perfectly with his dingy club and her boozy persona. It's just cringy. Never thought the film room was Kane's mind, but it's a wild idea suitable for a Twilight Zone. Yes, thank you. I really like that theory of Rick's quite a bit. And the fact that so many of the actors that are in Citizen Kane show up in the newsroom scene. I mean, they're all sort of anonymous. They're in shadow. But the fact that like Joseph Cotten is in there and some of the other actors, it almost kind of gives credence to that theory that these are people that have been through Kane's life and he's just repopulating them as he's sort of in his dream state. I thought it was a really, really, as you say, wild idea. Episode 7, The Girl on the Ferry. We've got a comment from Chris Franklin, of course, a member of our network. And he says, the discussion about hesitating for just a moment and wondering what could have been was fascinating. One encounter I'm proud of that's pretty much the opposite of this discussion was with the screen's original Lois Lane, Noelle Neal. My family went a day early for the Metropolis, Illinois' annual Superman celebration. We were walking through the Superman Museum there, and I noticed Miss Neal was also touring the museum and had pointed her out to Cindy. I had already decided I wasn't going to bother her. She was off the clock, and I could meet her tomorrow during the event if I wanted to. She noticed our son, Andrew, who was about 4 or 5 at the time, and struck up a conversation with him and then us. I'm not sure if she knew I was aware of who she was or not because I never fawned over her. She was just a nice lady talking to a cute little kid, and I'll always cherish that memory. It's actually my favorite celebrity encounter because it's a real moment. On the other hand, flash forward 11 years or so, and Andrew had a similar moment mentioned in the film at our local comic shop. A very cute redhead was checking him out and smiling at him. I saw it too, but he never spoke to her. We tried to figure out who she was later, but the owner never could identify her. When a cute comic-loving girl gives you the eye, you better take that chance. Those are both marvelous stories, Chris. From episode 11, Dinners with Emily, Jonathan Schaefer-Haim says, an earlier draft of the script, which you can read summarized in Harlan Labo's book, Citizen Kane, A Filmmaker's Journey, has Kane pursuing a scandal which he believes the president is involved in, which Emily disapproves of, as well as an attempted assassination of the president, the would-be assassin with a folded editorial from the Inquirer critical of the president. During this, you would see their marriage devolve over a longer period of time, and also it is clear that Emily has very strong anti-Semitic views. Well, scrapped all that and condensed their story to the brilliant piece of filmmaking that we get here, with the one line remaining about her opinions in that regard. So great catch, Terry. The bit about Jed as the truth teller was a really neat idea that I'm going to ponder for a while. It complements my wife's pet theory that Jed was in love with Citizen Kane, and the reason he was able to describe Charles and Emily's deteriorating relationship so well is that he knows exactly what it's like to fall out of love with Charlie Kane. That's great, John. I've never read Harlan Labo's book, as ashamed as I am to admit that. I thought I've read every book about Citizen Kane, but apparently I haven't read that one, and that sounds really fascinating, so I have got to check that out. From episode 12, Sentimental Journey, Jack Bone says, when a movie brings up the question of how long horses roam New York City, I feel compelled to bring up Speedy from 1928, in which Harold Lloyd tries to save the last horse-drawn trolley car against modern competition. This is probably the same part of my brain that obsesses over comics. At RKO, the magnificent Amberson staircase eventually converted to part of the boarding school of the seventh victim. The metaphor writes itself, doesn't it? From episode 21, Goodbye Charlie, Brian Linton says, let me get this straight. An old white guy with too much money brings in some pterodactyls to entertain his guests at a picnic? So Citizen Kane was the original Jurassic Park. This movie really did it all first. Now I can't help but imagine that scream at the end of the picnic scene is one of the picnickers being carried off by the pterodactyls. I'm sure Kane had all the guests sign waivers before heading into the Everglades. And finally, episode 24, we got two comments. Episode 24 was called The End. First one is from Captain Entropy, who says, Rob, congratulations and condolences on finishing the film 5 minutes at a time. All your guests have been great, but having Todd as the guest for the end of the movie was a perfect finishing touch. I mean, he's a genuine student of film who's absolutely ape over Citizen Kane. Yeah, I said it. Pun totally intended. What you going to do about it, My thanks to you and all your guests for an informative, entertaining, and thought-provoking ride. I didn't know Wells, but I suspect he would have enjoyed it. Well, thank you, Captain. We will, of course, never know that, but that's a nice thought. And then the final comment I want to read is, again, from Dr. Ange, where he says, congratulations on getting here. Quite a journey. On rewatching, I wonder if it was made today that the movie would end on the site of Rosebud burning up, because that's the punch. But I think Wells, by pulling back and showing us Xanadu with the plume of smoke, is saying, again, that Rosebud is important, but it isn't important. That shot going back to the no trespassing sign gives us, as viewers, time to chew over the reveal, but also reminds us that Kane was much, much more. I did want to say one more thing. Thank you. Because of this show, I have an even better understanding and appreciation of this film. But I can also enjoy this movie even more. As I said before, I spend so much time when I watch this trying to figure out if some shot, quote, means something or was just a cool way to do things. When watching the movie, I often found I've been mulling over something in my mind so much that I have missed actual minutes of the film. It is that homework feel to the movie. Anyways, because of this show, I have finally been able to really view, review, chew the movie in 5-minute chunks. The result? Well, when I went to see the movie at the Fathom event showing, I just sat back and watched it. I didn't need to mull things over because I already done all that recently. I just sat back and watched the movie for the first time in a long time, and I loved it, appreciated it even more. Thanks, Rob. I owe you one. Well, thank you, Ange, and thanks to everybody that listened and left comments and mentioned it on Twitter. I very much appreciate it. I love this movie. It's so important to me, and I wanted to sort of honor it in its 80th anniversary to do these 5 minutes. So thank you, Ange, and thanks to everybody for commenting and listening along. I very much appreciate it. So before we finally do wrap up the show here, I want to give a shout out to all of my guests, all the people that were nice enough to come by and talk this movie with me. As Orson might say, a good cast deserves a second mention. So big thanks to April Snellings, Jerry Green, Rick Heineken, Mariah E. Gates, Trey Hooks, Josh Karp, Steve Givens, Gord Tolton, Corey Musa, Dr. Ange, Terry O'Malley, Noah Tornow, Daniel Budnick, Tom Panarese, Ted Kelvington, Abel Padilla, John Trumbull, Max Romero, Corey Drew, Gabriel Hardman, Jill Blake, Jonathan Schaefer-Hames, Greer Sinclair, Todd Hartzell, and of course, Matthew Asprey Gear. Thanks to all of you for coming by and talking Citizen Kane with me. It was a real honor to speak to all of you about this movie that I love so much. So I guess that is going to do it. I said at the top of the show, I sort of joked whether is this really the final episode or not. It is and it isn't. For the foreseeable future, there will be no more episodes of Citizen Kane Minute. But one of the things that I love about podcasting as a medium is the format allows you to update your shows whenever you want. You don't have to make a whole lot of effort to restart it. So this show will just sort of live on forever. And of course, Citizen Kane's shadow looms so large in the popular culture that there are lots of things that I would love to talk about in relation to Citizen Kane. There was, of course, that great Simpsons episode that was just a half-hour-long parody of Citizen Kane, which for a lot of people of a certain age, that's how they know Citizen Kane, is from that Simpsons episode. There are other TV shows and other things out there related to Citizen Kane that I would love to discuss. And I think at some point down the line, I will cover some of those for this show. So this show will come back eventually. So please keep the show subscribed in your feed. And like Wells himself, you never know when it's going to show up. I look forward to doing those. But for right now, we're going to put a period at the end of the sentence. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I very, very much appreciate it. So, of course, we're still going to be talking Citizen Kane over on Twitter at Citizen Kane Minute. You can find all the back episodes on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. The show can be subscribed to on any podcatcher of your choice. I have to give a big thanks to Slick, who supported the show over on patreon.com/FWPodcasts. I very much appreciate it. And so that is going to do it. We're going to wrap up Citizen Kane Minute. Again, thank you, everyone, for listening. Very much appreciate it. And until the next bonus episode, whenever that might come, good night, everybody.
What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.